Let's pray. Father, again, we ask your guidance today as we open up your book. I pray that you would lead us into your truth and give us a clear view of what you would have us to do and to be, and give us a clear view of this chapter and story that we are about to read. I pray that you would bless every one of us through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Let's read the entire chapter, chapter 22. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And every one that was in distress, and every one that was in debt, and every one that was discontented gathered themselves unto him. And he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you, till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hold, depart and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. When Saul heard that David was discovered and that the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. Then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, Hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards, and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? And there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you that is sorry for me, or that showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, Hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here am I, my lord. And Saul said unto him, Why have ye conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thine house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto thy servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and did not show it to me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, Turn thou and fall upon the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priests, and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul. I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life. But with me thou shalt be in safeguard. There's a lot in this chapter. It has been said, and I have never studied this in very great depth, but I have heard it all my life, say that in the Old Testament, David is a type of Christ. I don't doubt the truth of it, though I am not exactly sure to what extent it goes, and I've never studied the whole subject out as to exactly all the ramifications of that statement. But I don't doubt for a moment right now that this chapter is a very clear picture of the church and the world. David, in the chapter, would be representing the leader, or the Lord, Christ. And Saul, in the chapter, would be representing Satan. And with Satan is the world, and with Christ is the church. If we look at that picture, and it clearly describes what we see in the scriptures as a description of the world versus the church, there is many, many deep things here that we can learn. And I don't know if we will be able to cover this chapter all this morning. But we'll get started. And I want to take you some places that I think very clearly are things that we need. We need to understand. If we have left the world, and if you are a Christian, you have left the world, because you can't be in the world and one of God's children. So if we have left the world, we are somewhere else. And there's only two groups of people on the earth. There's the people who do not love God, and they are destined for hell. And there are the people who do love God, and they are going to heaven. Those are the two groups of people. There's nobody in between that's undecided yet. You're already on one side or the other. Some people in the world may think they are on God's side, and they may say good things about God, and they may go to church, and they may read their Bible, but yet, at the end of the day, if they are unconverted, living for themselves, they are in the camp of the world. And there's another group of people that truly have been washed by the blood of Christ and have been made a son of God by the Spirit of God, and they belong to the church. But they don't know what they don't know what the church is. And they don't fulfill their duty as Christians to the church. What you say, what is my duty? If I'm a Christian, what is my duty to the church? You know, the Bible is extremely clear over and over and over and over again what the duties of God's people are. And many people who are Christians spend more energy on blood relationships that are still in this world and lost, which is we should spend energy on these people. We should be trying to bring them into the church, okay? We should take care of the needs of any fellow man, saved or lost. There's many things that we should do with the people who are not saved. Yet they are no longer our family. We left them. We're in a new family. And the responsibilities to our new family are what make our lives as a Christian if we are obedient to the scriptures. It's what we live for. And those duties to the church, because they should make up the basic form of your life, is nothing that we can sit and go through and say, well, this is it. It's not something that we can write on this board up here and say, this is it. It's not something that we can take you to a verse of scripture and say, this is it. Because it is a lifestyle. It is an all-engrossing lifestyle that is what makes who you are. And what you see in this chapter, there are good men in this chapter, and there are bad men in this chapter. Saul was a bad man. He was reigning over the nation of Israel. He was extremely wicked at this point in his life, though God had chosen him to be the king. He cannot be in any way put on a higher plane than what you would think of when you think of Hitler. What he did in this chapter, because one man in complete innocence, knowing nothing of anything, fed David when he came through his city. What he did, Saul killed this priest for, and killed all the family that he could get his hands on, went to the city where the priest lived, killed all their wives, all their friends, all their animals, until there was nothing left in the city. This is Hitler kind of attitude. This is Saul. This was the king of Israel. And God had anointed him to be the king of Israel, but he had left God's calling. So he is as wicked a man inside his heart. He was as wicked a man as you've ever met anywhere in your life. But he had a son named Jonathan. And this Jonathan was a good man. He was a godly man. He stood for none of his father's wickedness. He stood up to his father, even though his father tried to kill him for it. He stood up in defense of David. But Jonathan stayed with his father in the wrong place. So we have Saul as head of the world, and we have Saul's son joining his father when he should have left his father. And then we have David out here, now anointed of God to be the king, but not reigning yet. It's exactly what we have right now in our time, right now. We have Jesus, absolute certainty. He is anointed to be the king. His kingdom is already set. There's a time that it's coming. God knows the time, and it's absolutely certain he's going to reign over the entire earth. But right now, he isn't reigning. But he's got a band of people gathered around him that we call the church. And these people that gather around Christ serve him, live for him, do what he does, and stay with him. That's where Jonathan should have been. Jonathan should have left his father. He should have walked off from that wicked situation and gone out and joined with David, who his father was trying to kill. That would have been the right place for Jonathan to have been as somebody who loved God. But he didn't. He didn't. Perhaps he was ignorant. Perhaps he just didn't want to displease his family. It's hard to say exactly what motivated Jonathan to do what he did. But he made the wrong decision. Consequently, because Jonathan made the wrong decision, he lost his power as a person. Jonathan, you remember, was the man who, with his armor bearer, single-handed, when the rest of the nation of Israel wouldn't fight with the Philistines, Jonathan and his armor bearer had gone alone and won a battle. And it had turned into a major victory for Israel. But Jonathan's next battle that we're going to read about, he's going to die in the battle. Why? What changed? Where is the faith? Where was the faith that led Jonathan to do the things that he did and to win a victory for God? Where did that go? Well, the fact of the matter is, no doubt Jonathan still had that faith in his heart, but he was with somebody who was going to lose the battle. The person who he was under was going to lose the battle, and the people that were with him were going to die in the battle, because the battle was going to be lost. And you go with the wrong kind of people, and the wrong kind of things are going to happen to you. That's written all throughout the scriptures. So, Jonathan was a good and godly person, but he made a wrong decision to stay with his father when he should have left. It was a decision that cost him everything. It was a decision that cost him the success in his life that he should have had. Then, on the other hand, there was a bunch of people who were not good people that went to join David. This picture just gets prettier and prettier and prettier and prettier as you go through it. You know what this church is? Just a bunch of sinners. And you know what? David accepted every single one of those people that came, just like Jesus always does. Listen to what it says. Everyone that was in distress, everyone that was in debt, everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. Now, we only have this little glimpse of these people in this verse. But as you read further into the story, some of these people who are with David are called the men of the devil. The sons of Belial said this. Some of these people who gathered together with David were not good people. But you know what? God never did accept a good person into his church before. He only ever did accept sinners into his church. And the one thing that makes the difference between one sinner and another sinner, it's not how bad you were or what you did, but whether or not you are willing to confess what you are and are willing to go put yourself under Jesus Christ the Lord. And that's what all of these people did. Now, this being a picture of the church does not mean that all of these people were actually Christians, because this is a story of history. But as a picture of the church, of course, this is what salvation is. Anybody, no matter how bad they are, when they come to Jesus Christ and get entered into a new place, when they become part of the church, they come as a sinner or they don't get through the door. There's no other way in. You can go around talking about the good things of your life as long as you want. And you can be absolutely certain that you have done way more good things in your life than you have done bad things. And you can record those good things in a book. And you can believe in those good things, but you can't get into church with them. If you're going to get into church, you're going to have to come to God as a sinner, where nothing on earth can save your soul except the sacrifice of God's Son. That's how you get in. You know, it's funny as we read this chapter that David is in hiding. How do these people find him? There's 400 men that gather to David. There's a whole bunch of funny things about this, actually. How do you hide with 400 men? Should we play hide and seek this afternoon and try it? Let's not worry about the 400. I'll be the counter. I'll come and find you. Brandon will be the hider, and I want you to hide with the rest of the church. Where are you going to hide? You don't have to tell me. I'm going to find you anyway. How was David hiding with 400 people? And how was it that Saul didn't know where David was, but everyone that was discontented and everyone that was in debt and everyone that was distressed did know where David was? You know, this is very highly spiritual, because the way to God isn't a path that can be seen with the physical eyes. But you know, when you are burdened down under the weight of your sin, and you found Jesus Christ to be sufficient to take care of it, you know you found the way. Anybody can come to you and tell you anything they want about religion and about God. The atheist can argue with you, but when you found the way, you know you're on the way. You know where you're going. And somehow, Jesus is not visible to the world. They can't see him. But the people who are in distress and who are in debt and who are discontented, the people who have come to the knowledge of themselves can find Jesus, though the rest of the world can't see him. And so 400 little men can find him, but the king with an army cannot. The king with the army never did find David. He met David 2 more times in his life. And both of those times were because David came to him. Saul never found David. He searched for him for years. He had a whole army to search. And he was looking for somebody with 400 people with him, and he never found him. The world cannot know God. The world does not know God. Every time the world opens their mouth and tells you something, stop your ears, because they know nothing about what they're talking about, because they have failed to see the biggest thing that exists in all of, not the universe, something beyond the universe. They failed to find the biggest thing alive. And they go on telling us how to live our lives. And so many of us Christians are listening to them. We think they've got it. They know what they're talking about. When they tell us that in order to do this, you have to go to college. In order to be successful, you have to have this much school. In order to do this, and on and on they talk. And Christians are listening to it. And we as Christians are losing everything that is of God out of our lives because we're listening to the world. We're losing what is of God. But the world doesn't know God. They've never seen him. They've never found him. They don't know who he is. We Christians, when we come to that place where we know ourselves and we understand what sin is, then we find God. I don't know which direction to go, if I should just pursue this in order here. There's 2 things that I really want to get out of this chapter. I want to get a clear understanding and definition of what the church is. I also want to get a clear understanding and definition of what, well, we could just say what the world is. But I'm thinking specifically the government. And the government is what comes next in this chapter. After we get through these first few verses where David's family comes to him, and David takes his mom and his dad and finds a place for them to live. They were apparently too old to run around with him. So he takes care of his mom and dad, finds a place for them to live. And then it says in verse 6, when Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, drop to verse 8, 7 rather, then Saul said unto his servants that stood around him, hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, that ye have all conspired against me? Now I cannot find a better picture of the government of the United States of America than that verse. When and how did we human beings get introduced to the idea that the government was supposed to give us things? Where did the idea that the government was here to give us things come from? Let me tell you where it came from. It is not of God. And there are two basic sources for information. There's two basic sources of things in this life on earth. We have God and we have Satan. If that idea did not come from God, it did come from the devil. The government was never created by God to give human beings things. They are not here to give us food. They are not here to provide a shelter. They are not here to help us in any way, shape, or form. The only purpose of the government under God is, I shouldn't say the only, because someone will come and correct me. The main purpose of the government under God is to keep evildoers punished. That is the main purpose of government. If somebody is not a decent citizen, they are to be punished by those in authority. That is their main job is to keep law and order. That's the purpose of the government. The government is not here to make your garden grow or to put food in your refrigerator. But Saul is speaking to the people who are standing around him. And this is what Saul asked the people. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will this young man give every one of you fields and vineyards? You know, when Israel came into the land, God gave them fields and vineyards. And the government is always trying to take the place of God. Because the governments of this world, the Bible says, are under Satan. The governments of this world, Satan is controlling. And Satan wants to be the God of this world. And so Satan doesn't like God's gifts to men. If he can steal God's gifts to men and re-give them, he's now God. And it's the only way Satan can ever do anything. It's the only way Satan can ever give anything is to take something that God made and give it. Because Satan never did make anything. So when the children of Israel came into the land, Joshua divided the land up for an inheritance to all the people. They already got fields and vineyards. How would it be if David were to give them fields and vineyards? How would he do it? You know, there is only one way that the government can ever do that for any person. That's to take it from somebody who already has it. Every single time the government becomes a gifter to any human being, they take it from somebody else to give it. It's unbiblical, it's immoral, it's wrong. God never set up any government that way. That is the government of Satan. It's wrong. It is wrong morally. It is morally wrong. But if these people were expecting to receive something from the government, Saul goes even further and he loses his mind on the next two statements. Because he says, and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds. And you know, this is, again, the United States government in all of its wicked immorality against God. Some people think we have a Christian government in this nation. We do not. The very foundation of our government never was Christian. Many of the people in our government had Christian morals, and some of them were probably Christians. But the foundation of our government is not of God. Sorry that I have to say that. Why is it the most desirable thing that a human being could be offered to be made in some way a ruler in the land? Why would somebody want to be working for the state? Why does somebody want to be a lawmaker? Why does somebody want to be the president? Why does somebody want to be elected to be something in the country? Why? Let me show you something that God says. Turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. We recently went through this, and we're going to make a comparison. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, it says in verse 10, Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, "This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself and for his chariots and to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyard and give it to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And he will take the tenth of your sheep and he will take, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king which ye have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." The people had come to Samuel way back here in this chapter before Saul was ever anointed to be king, before Israel had ever had a king over them. They came to Samuel and they said, "Make us a king." And Samuel went and talked to God about it. And God said, "Well, if they want a king, why don't you go tell them what the king will do?" And God was warning them that the king that would come to them would do things that were bad for the country. And this is his list. And you'll never guess that the very first king that they elected to be the king over Israel did everything that God said he was going to do, and he talked to the people as though it was for their benefit. Does this sound like the United States government? It does to me. Why is it desirable that we should be taken and be made a captain over a thousand? Why is that desirable? You know, there's one thing only that it can do for a human being. It can give you something that is beyond your personal reach without it. And it appeals to different people in different ways. It may be the money, it may be the power, it may be the honor, there may be a number of different things that might appeal to a person to be in that position. But I can tell you right now, it is a loss to your personal life. If you are there and you are there for a good reason, it would be something that you would give of your own free will for the sake of the humans that were under you. And it would be something you would be giving up to do it. It is not a benefit to you. What do you have to do to get in a position like that? Well, guess what? Back at home, there was peace. Maybe. If you were serving God, there should be. There's a wife. I'm sure you married the prettiest of them. Your children. Your animals. Your garden. Your home. And we all say there's no place like home. And we're going to take all this place where life was the way God made it, and we're going to give it up to come and be the ruler over 1,000 people. And these 1,000 people aren't happy because they don't have that peaceful situation that God made every human being to enjoy. And you're going to get everybody that knows you mad at you every day of your life for being in that position. The king who put you there is going to be mad at you because you're never going to do a good enough job. The people who you're over are going to be mad at you. Life is going to be stressful. I am telling you, that situation is a situation that many people should be in, but they should be in it because they love human beings and they are willing to bear what it takes to help people. There should be people there. But it is not a place that brings you more happiness. It is a place that brings you more stress. Happiness is the way God created life. Happiness was simple. It happened at home. It happened when you didn't have all these things that man never did need. And the king now, instead of heeding the words of God, where God said, the king's going to do this, 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 and this, and this to the people, instead of the king heeding the words of God and saying, I'll try as hard as I can to be the least intrusive that I possibly can be on this nation to make things run smoothly, instead of doing that, he adopts in his mind that that is best for the people that he do it. Okay, so it says, I want you to catch this verse that we read over. He will take, verse 14 said in chapter 8, he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. Now jump back to the chapter that we were just in. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? What was Saul's philosophy? Saul's philosophy was that it was right for him to take vineyards and olive yards from people to give them to his servants. And do you know what? David was a man after God's own heart. That means David didn't have that philosophy because that philosophy came from the devil. So because David didn't have that philosophy, it was true that David would not give them vineyards and fields. But Saul would. So Saul is trying to maintain his position of superiority over David by embracing Satan's philosophy. Now, who was it good for? And this is the problem with our government right now in this country, is that many times half of everything the government does is not good for the country, it's not good for the people, it's not good for the land, it's not good for the world, but it is good for those in government. Now, I understand we have a relatively honest and upright moral government in America. Relatively, I said. Compared to many other governments in many other countries. There's a lot of very wicked things in the government. But we don't have a terrible government. Our government is trying to run on morals. Nevertheless, over and over and over and over and over again, the things that the government does, the laws they enact, the way they want the country to be run, has one major thing behind it. It benefits the government. That's not the way God made government. I wish I could get through this. This is such an important point. I might go a couple minutes late today, if you guys don't mind. I want you to think about this for a minute. How did God make government? Well, the fact of the matter is, let's go back to the beginning. Government existed right from the beginning. The very first man God ever created, God immediately became the king over and he made him a law. Okay? How much reading material did Adam need to go through to understand the will of God? None. Would you guys like to go try to read the laws of our country? It fills up walls of shelves. We have the federal government who is over us. Then we are in a state, so we have the state government that's over us. But we are also in a county, so we have the county government that's over us. There's three sets of laws. And you don't want to read any of the laws of any of them. In fact, we're never even expected to. We're expected to obey them, but we're not expected to read them. God never made a book like that. The book that God made is something that we can read. We can understand everything that's written in it. So when God made Adam, He put him in a garden. He gave Adam trees that were planted. And He just told Adam his only job was to take care of the garden. So Adam could just live there. It was free. There was no tax collector. God did not create taxes. Man made taxes. And I'm not saying taxes are bad. Let me tell you something. We humans are in a big mess because of our sin. There's many things that we suffer in life because of our sin. And because we need government over us, it has to be that the government has to be supported. So taxes are not a bad thing. I'm saying God didn't create them. Okay, that's something of man. That's not of God. God tells us to pay them, but He didn't create them. When God made the world, he didn't need anything from Adam. So He didn't ask Adam for anything. But you say, God did ask us to do things. Like, for example, go through the Old Testament and find out that God asked for the Israelites to bring the tithe or the tenth part of all of their increase to the temple. Okay, good point. Let's think about that for a minute. In fact, we'll just turn to Malachi chapter 3 and we'll just read about it for a moment. Why did God ask the Israelites to give a tenth of everything they had to the temple? Why did He ask that? Well, because there was going to be people who was going to be working in the temple and they had to be supported. So it was very logical. You see the fact of the matter is, the things that man brought to the temple went to man. God didn't get them. He did not have one of those bank tubes coming down into the temple where they had to put their gifts in and it went shooting up to heaven. God didn't get the things that came to the temple. The things that came to the temple, man got. But listen to what God says in Malachi chapter 3. It says in verse 10, "Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall the vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts, and all nations shall call you blessed." Every single time God ever asked for a human being to give anything to God, He always stood there with something more for you than what you were going to give for. Let's imagine that you're playing the lottery. And one day you go into the gas station. Don't you ever do this. You go into the gas station and you give the lady your $2. And you get a little piece of paper back. And that piece of paper doesn't do anything for you. It's worthless. You check it hoping it'll have some value, but it's worthless. And hundreds and hundreds and millions of times people do that. And they go give their little bits of money. And they come back and that piece of paper they got was worthless. And then one day somebody goes in there and they pay their little bit of money and they win $10 million. You know, playing the lottery in this world with God is like every time you go in there and give your $2, you win $1 million. It's not a play to win, it's a give and win every time. It's not that you might win, it's that you do win. And every single time that God asks for anything from any human being, He's always standing there waiting to give back what He asked for. Only what we give Him is stupid things He doesn't even want. We give Him things He created. He could create another earth full of gold and put it out there somewhere where no human being was to take it. And he could have all the money he wanted if he wanted money, but he doesn't have anywhere to spend it anyway because he's got all that he wants. He doesn't need anything from us, but he asks for things from us. And every time he asks for things from us, he always gives them to somebody. And then he pays us back. But he pays us back sometimes in different ways. We don't always understand God. This is tough sometimes because, you know, sometimes God says to his people, we're going to go there next. He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord. Now I've heard glowing stories of people who have found somebody who is poor and struggling, and in spite of the fact that they themselves were not well off and struggling themselves, they helped this poor person. And the next day or the next week, somebody hands them a big check or something amazing happens like that. You know what? We've all experienced the other way. We have all experienced, if you have ever taken care of the poor, you have experienced times where you help somebody out that it puts you in a worse financial situation and God didn't send piles of money rolling your way. But he did something. Can we go to that verse in Proverbs chapter 9? In Proverbs chapter 9, it says in verse 17. No, it doesn't. Okay. Proverbs 19. He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given will he pay him again. Now, any time that you have ever lent to anybody that was credible, you expect the thing that you lent to be returned. Sometimes with interest, sometimes without. It depends on the agreement. But you would never lend to somebody who is credible that you did not expect a return of the thing that you lent. Is God credible? Do we all believe that God is righteous? If we believe that God is righteous and he says that which he hath given will he pay him again. What does it mean if you have money and you take care of the poor in Jesus' name, doing something that he asked you to do, and God says he will give it back to you, when will you see it? Have you ever struggled for many years in poverty, and during the time that you were poor? You gave things to people because they were poor and you still struggled in poverty. You ever did that? I am not God. But I do have faith. One thing that I am absolutely certain is that when you take it upon yourself to take care of God's people, what he gives you will be something that you will be very pleased with. Now, the fact of the matter is, if God never gave you a dime and he let you die of starvation after you helped a poor person and you got to go to heaven and get the mansion that Jesus built for you, you would be quite happy. But I don't think that's exactly what God is talking about. I think that he means something a little bit more earthly than that when he says he will pay him again. I'll let God run his own business. I'll let God take care of his own bank. All I am saying here today is God never asked you to do anything for him that he was not standing there ready to give you something back that was above and beyond anything that you ever gave. I remember that verse that Jesus gives in that precious story in Luke about the prodigal son. When the prodigal comes to himself and he says, how many servants of my father have bread enough and to spare? And that is a picture, such a picture of God. God never runs out. God could give every person everything that they could ever want, and He's always got more. He sits up in heaven millions and millions of times bigger than the entire earth, which He made out of His words. And He looks at puny man who don't trust Him, and He says, you know, it's okay if you get out there on the edge a little bit and do the things that I said, because I'm sitting here with enough resources to do for you what needs to be done. Some of those times, some of those resources that He has for us are not always the things that we're looking for, but they're always good for us. That's the government of God. God did not set up a government where He over the people needed something from man to run the country. That's man's government. Right, the rightness or the wrongness or the extent to which it should be used is up for a large argument. God did not tell the nation of Israel that the king should not do these things. He told the nation of Israel that the king would do those things. The king, that was the government. If you want a government that isn't God, which God says, I don't know why you need a king. He said, I've always been your king. He reminds them of the things that He did for them while He was their king. And he wonders why they need a king. But He says, you know, if you want to have a king, this is how the king's going to be. He's going to take your stuff for Himself. That's our government. It says in verse 6, Now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and his servants were all standing about him. How many of you guys feel like that is an appealing lifestyle, to live under a tree with your spear in your hand and your servants standing about you? How many of you think that was an appealing lifestyle for his servants? And then as though he has something to hold over the heads of these servants of his, he makes a difference between Jesse, who was God's chosen man, and himself, who is now serving the devil. He makes a difference between the way David, the son of Jesse rather, that David would run the country versus the way he himself had planned to run the country. But you know, the fact of the matter was, he wasn't working at this time on getting vineyards and fields for his servants anyway. He was actually working to try to kill David. That was what took up most of the rest of his life. That's what became the consuming passion in his heart, was that David had to go because David was a threat to him. And that's what the world is working on. God has to go. The book has to go. The people of God have to go because they stand in our way. That's the philosophy of the world. There's another one. It says in Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 2, it says, Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee and that thou mayest live long on the earth. When God said to the children of Israel, when He was giving the children of Israel His laws for them, one of the Ten Commandments was honor thy father and thy mother. Take care of them. You are to take care of your mother and your father. Now, that was God asking for some of our precious things. Every time that we young people set out to begin life on our own, we all have lots of needs. We all need toys. We all need fun. We all need restaurant food. We all need games. We all need, we think we all need all these things. And we begin, we become engrossed in beginning to build our own lives. But the Bible says to honor your father and your mother so that you can live a long life. So, in other words, to give what we have to another human being means we get paid from God, because who else gives life besides God? God gives life. He owns it. Do you guys see the difference between the way the people of God are and the way the world is? The thought patterns are completely different. We're here for service to man without asking anything back from man, because God pays us. The world is here to serve themselves. And because they only have one source, which is earth, they need man to become their source. It's two completely different theories. And I have not gone into the church yet. We have to go there next. We have to look at some of the way God set up a church to run, what a church is expected to be, how it's expected to be. And we're 10 minutes late already. So we'll finish this chapter another time, and we will dismiss for today.